Hello and welcome to Science Unscripted. It's Connor here.
And Gabe.
We have a lot of science for you today, which is why we're going to keep the email segment a little shorter, very short. Mm. Just one of our listeners who writes in, and she says, she was actually writing because she was trying to track down an episode that she listened to and then couldn't find online. I just want to let this listener know that we have corrected that is now available everywhere. It really is.
A couple weeks back, or what
yeah,
was this?
Yeah, as simple as there's a box when you're publishing things online that in our content management system, and if you forget to tick that one box, then it doesn't appear on our website or anywhere. It's kind of crazy. So that has been rectified anyway. Peanuts
allergies, peanut allergies. Did you guys see this a couple weeks back? A study was published saying that. They've gone down big time in the United States. And I just wanted to talk a little bit about why that happened. It goes back to a physician of Israeli descent who noticed at the time he was in London and he saw the prevalence of peanut allergy of the Jewish community where he was in London. And then he compared that to where his homeland, where peanut allergies are almost 0%. And among this community in London, around 2%. That corresponds to the rest of the population in the Western world, around 2%, have this allergy. And he was wondering, why is that? And then he thought to himself, maybe it's because infants in Israel are fed this certain type of peanut chip. In Germany, they're called flips. They're like puffy.
Those are delicious.
Cheeto-like.
Cheetos
flavored.
Cheetos.
With actual peanuts in them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All those things. If you pop that bag open here in Germany, you will eat every single flip.
They're awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyways, Israeli infants eat these, and he was thinking to himself, maybe there's something going on there. This was back in 2008, and then this guy set up an experiment to test the causation of this, because back then it was an association, it was a hypothesis, and then he wanted to test it. And he tested back in 2008. He found 630 infants. Some who showed sensitivity to a proclivity to peanut allergies, and did an experiment with them, testing giving half of them peanuts at a
low dosage,
6 months all the way up to age 5, and the others didn't. And then he saw that the numbers were off the charts. The ones that were given the peanuts at a young age did not have the allergy at the age of 5. And based on that experiment, the United States changed their guidelines. The NIH, which partially funded that experiment, National Institutes of Health in the United States, changed the guidelines in 2017, telling parents you can give your kid, your infant, low levels of peanuts. Mm-hmm. Because before that, it was told to avoid them out of safety.
Of course. So you don't have a hospital
visit. So that nothing happens. And since between 2017 and 2024, prevalence dropped by 43%. So it's just an amazing instance of how the scientific method can have absolutely real world effects.
Well, and saving lives in there.
Between 40,000 and 50,000, if you run the numbers, that 43% prevalence going that decrease of 43% could mean up to 50,000 kids spared that allergy. Now, we're not saying right now if you have an infant at home, feed it these flips, or bambas as they're called in Israel, because that would be dangerous. You should definitely consult a doctor, and you can do a test for a peanut allergy that would tell you whether you can feed it. But
it's how interesting that all just came from one person's observation.
One doctor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how many lives?
Gideon Luck. Yeah.
That has improved. Yeah, exposure therapy. Different kind of diet and a totally different animal here. I've got two animal stories. Both of them, if this information had been available to me a couple weeks back, I might have packaged it pre-Halloween because they're kind of, I don't know, scarier animals. First one is, I'll just give the title of the study. It was published in Frontiers in Marine Science, Novel Evidence of Interaction Between Killer Whales, so orcas, and Juvenile White Sharks.
Okay.
And that buries the lead or doesn't really do it justice, because what's going on here, great white sharks have one natural enemy that can eat them, and it's the orca.
The orca.
That is, I believe, and there's probably a marine biologist or somebody who just likes this kind of stuff, a tough battle right? You can get severely wounded by a white shark, even as an orca.
Yeah.
And what they've observed now, what the study is about, is three different times in the same location, so off the coast of Mexico in the Pacific, the same group of five orcas, I think they call them the Moctezuma pod, I don't know, if, luring out or somehow finding juvenile white sharks, and then flipping them upside down as they bring them to the surface, because this upside down phase or situation induces something, I have to look at it again, called tonic immobility. It temporarily paralyzes them, and they don't, they stop. It's almost like they're asleep but awake, and they stop doing anything at all. And then in, I believe, each of the three cases, they push them back down underwater and eat very specifically the juvenile white shark's liver and share it among the pod. It's an energy-rich part of the shark's body, and it's possible that there are other organs being eaten as well, but it's very specifically the liver, and they're doing this as a group in a coordinated manner. Again, three different times, twice in August of 2020, once in August of 2022, so, and in the same area. And the authors say, you know, why would they be doing this with the juveniles, not the adults?
Is this them playing with their prey, akin to like kittens?
It's an easy, I believe, an easy snack. Okay. And the juvenile white sharks are...
But flipping, with the flipping up and down and inducing this paralysis, is that just them playing with it?
No, they're making it easy to...
Make it easier. Okay.
Yeah, make it easy to do what they want to do.
Got it.
And that was such a bizarre state for those animals to be in. That I ended up looking for another study on that. Why on earth? That's a huge weakness. Oh, powerful animal, but if you just twist it, what, 180 degrees, it is like the least powerful animal ever. And scientists aren't really sure. The a couple different theories. This is a paper published in 2023. It could be a passive defensive response against a predatory attack. I don't really understand how that makes sense, but kind of playing dead. A component of courtship and copulation, so this kind of different state of mind, that would make sense to me, or a protective mechanism limiting the effect of overwhelming sensory stimulation. Okay, but yeah, makes them very vulnerable and an easy snack. If you'd like, you can go take a look at the paper. They have video footage. It's a long video showing each of these attacks from above. I think they had a drone flying above. Or... One thing I can recommend is if you're interested in orcas, just finished kind of a children's novel by an author. She's from Oregon, I think, Roseanne Perry, called A Wolf Called Fire, where you really feel like you're a wolf. You see the world the way they do. She's also written one about orcas called A Whale of the Wild. I can kind of recommend that, I guess, without having read it. Last bit of animal science here. Those of you who have watched Lord of the Rings, Gabe, you've watched the trilogy?
I saw all three of them, yeah.
Yeah, okay. You'll remember a scene where Frodo, who's attempting to take the Ring of Power to Mordor and get rid of it, he is led or misled by Sméagol, Gollum, into this cave. And what Gollum knows is that's where Shelob lives, this huge spider.
Oh,
and so Gollum knows... Frodo is going to get stung by the spider, killed and eaten, and he, Gollum, will end up getting the ring back.
Yeah.
It's a pretty horrifying scene because, well, that's not a spoiler at this point. Frodo gets wrapped up in the webs.
Yeah.
Something like that has kind of been found in real life.
Spider?
Not the spider, because that was a huge spider.
I was going to say.
But the web,
sort of. Yeah,
if you want to go and look at the pictures later, you can.
Yeah.
This was a team, really very international, but all European team, that went down to the border of Greece and Albania. For those of you out there who can't place Albania in your mental map, if you have the boot of Italy and the heel of the boot, you go right across the water to the east, and there you're in Albania.
Mm-hmm.
Right on the border between Albania and Greece, there's a very stinky river. In fact, the canyon, I think in Greek, is called Stinky Canyon or something.
Mm-hmm.
They went into a cave, and down in this cave, they found a 100 square meter spider web curtain.
100 square meter?
Spider web curtain. And on that spider web curtain, I'm going to pass a picture to you, Gabe. I've seen these in my own home. You may have as well. That was... one of two spider species that they found there, that is Tegenaria domestica. in Europe here called the domestic house spider. I about once every two weeks.
Yeah, the Kreuzspinne here, right? Nice thick.
I don't know. I think that's that may be a different one. Okay. I don't know what the German word for it is. I just know that every 2 weeks or 3 weeks, somebody in my family says, hey, can you bring a cup and a piece of paper and then put the spider in there? And
there's
then
a portion
up.
Of our living room where Heidi will not go
because of
one of those came out of the corner.
Yeah, you see them everywhere. In North America, they're called the barn funnel weaver.
Oh, yeah.
And on this spider web curtain, deep inside of a cave, there were roughly 69,113
roughly.
Yeah, I like the specificity of that number. And it was really just, they looked at probably at 1 or 2 square meters and counted and then extrapolated.
Yeah, sure.
And there were another 40,000 roughly of a smaller, more translucent spider, all living harmoniously. That was the kind of the takeaway. Oh, that's possible in huge numbers.
And they had worked together to build this gigantic web, or what's going on here?
I believe primarily the domestic house spider was responsible for the web. The other one, the Prinerigona vagans, which is a smaller, more translucent spider. I'm not sure the extent to which it contributed to the web itself, but they're all living harmoniously in there, and which is also 100,000 plus spiders, which is also kind of disturbing because it means that there's enough food for to be alive down in this cave that's called the Sulfur Cave. If you want to go to the Sulfur Cave yourself, there's a map showing you how to get there in the study itself, in the paper. Paper's called An Extraordinary Colonial Spider Community in Sulfur Cave, Sustained by Chemoatrophy.
Yeah.
And in the journal Subterranean Biology. What a journal, Subterranean Biology. The only thing I'll say is, yeah, probably don't go there for a lot of reasons. One, it could be dangerous.
Well, it stinks, too. I was thinking you were going to call it the Bromine Cave because... That would come from bromos, the ancient Greek for stench.
It was something. It started,
I was thinking bromine too.
It started with a V.
Sulfur.
I should have written that down. No. But what I will say as actual practical advice to all the people out there, a lot of young European backpackers, I've heard them, or people in that age, like they say the same thing. The new Croatia is Albania. It's the cool place for people in their 20s to go.
Okay.
And a lot of people are going there now. It's like on the radar. It wasn't before.
You don't have a side gig for the Albanian tourism industry.
Come visit Albania. No, it's supposed to be nice. I'd like to go there.
Yeah.
That's it.
Let's enter the arena of American politics for 1 second.
We are dealing with a party that is so extreme considers its opponents to be its mortal enemies, that dehumanizes its opposition, that justifies violent attacks.
That's the voice of Stephen Miller, a senior White House official, deputy chief of staff. We're not going to be talking politics or what party does what here. It's just the use of the term dehumanization. That's it. I have a problem with that partly because of interviews that we've done on this show. But when you use this term too often or when you misuse it, it leads to that word being cheapened, weakened, possibly normalized, especially if someone with this kind of power uses it. It can be used by other people. It could lead to it losing its meaning.
And it dilutes the effect of a word that should be used sparingly and accurately because...
It's stage four on an established, sociologically and historically established 10 stages that lead towards genocide. This is something that was put together by Dr. Gregory Stanton from George Mason University in anthropology, who studied genocide for years and years and looked at different instances of it all over the world and pointed out that dehumanization is an early warning sign leading towards extermination. Stage 10 is extermination. It starts with categorization into groups, us and them, and then comparing that group to an animal or to
an
insect.
That's the most common. There are a lot of ways to dehumanize.
Yeah.
In one episode, and this is really neither here nor there, on this show we talked about how if men are nasally injected or nasally inhale testosterone, that they dehumanize women at a higher rate. And there it was about emotionally dehumanizing them, taking away their ability or saying that they wouldn't experience emotions in the same way. There are a lot of ways to do it, but the most important one is animal comparisons, reducing a group of people to an animal.
1994 in Rwanda, the 900,000 victims that were sliced up in a span of 3 months, they were compared to cockroaches. In Germany in the 1930s and 40s, the Nazis called the Jews and the Bolsheviks and the degenerates, as they called them, vermin, Volksschädling. That was one of the parts. And in this analysis by Dr. Stanton, he saw that everywhere, all over the world, this is an important part. That's why this term, we should be very careful how it is used. When you hear it being used, think, is this actually being used correctly? Because one of the things that those perpetrators of genocide around the world say about themselves, that they are normal people. In Rwanda, they were looked at as going doing field work, just normal work. Yeah, in the end, it was using a machete to cut up your neighbor, but they thought it was normal work. We spoke with someone from Ohio University about this very thing, about these people 25 years after the genocide reintegrating into society and them comparing themselves, calling themselves good people.
Well, and very importantly, if you are going to remain aware of what those early warning signs are and what their actual and correct definitions are, you'll be better able to see something potentially catastrophic coming. Right? If everyone, words can be diluted and have their meanings change, and then it's harder to talk about something that may actually be happening. And there are a lot of very scary situations all around the world. One of them in Sudan right now, where that question is being thrown around. And it's important to be able to use that word dehumanization accurately, to know when people are doing it, how they're doing it, and what it could potentially lead to.
Okay, that is enough. It's just we really wanted to discuss that because of how much it matters to us and really to the world. What, do you guys have anything to say about it? SUDW.com, shoot us an email.
Hier doch mal für zwei Minuten bequem. Ich hoffe, der Sound ist locker und die Raps sind gut zu verstehen. Setz dich am besten hin, mein Freund, du kannst doch ruhig noch einen drehen. Genieß die Tracks, hör ganz genau hin und versuch es zu sehen. Ich geb's euch doch bildlich gesprochen, weiß ihr checkt, dass darin Liebe steckt. Hab mir mein Ziel gesteckt, dass ich's erreich, will ich mal hoffen. Diese Scheibe soll ein Anfang sein. Mehr als der Standard-Scheiß, den ihr anderen reißt. Ich machte fast alles ganz allein, auf Fehler fangen wir an Parteien. Bin ich durchs Land gereist, bei Sessions angeheizt. Die Stadt im Schweiß, als wär's Zwangsarbeit. Zwei Mann am Mic, manchmal drei, die einen Standpunkt teilen. Je nach Programm und Zeit. Hieß es auch ab und zu mal Wandanschreiner, Beats gebaut in Handarbeit. Muss ich erst Platten liegen, 5 Uhr raus zum Flohmarkt. Frühstück gab's nicht, nur eine Schachtel kippen. Später die Sachen mischen, blieb lange im Schatten sitzen. Aus Massen Skizzen, Texte schreiben, auch bei Affenhitze. Komm raus ans Licht und genieße jeden Augenblick. Lebe jetzt und pack in jeden Text, was in meinem Schädel wächst. CAS, der von der Seele rappt. Also lass mich erzählen, nimm dir noch etwas Zeit, hör zu und mach's dir bequem.
Hi, my name is Giacomo Bignardi, short is Giaco, and I'm a doctoral student at the Max Planck Institute for Psycholinguistics, where I'm studying music, genetics, and art. And together with a group of co-workers at the Max Planck Institute for Empirical Aesthetics, I just published a paper in Nature Communication on music, genetics, and pleasure.
Giaco, if you had to choose one chief finding from this paper that you and your colleagues just published, what is it exactly? What did you find?
The capacity to experience pleasure from music is heritable. This is number one. The second thing is that genetic effects that can explain variability in experience pleasure from music are partially independent from the ability to perceive music and to feel pleasure in general. And three, that there might be mostly distinct genetic effects to different facets on the ways people experience music.
And when you say heritable, what you're saying there is that if my ability to feel pleasure when I listen to music, let's say I'm riding the car, great song comes on, and I'm on cloud nine, that feeling in me is inherited from one or both of my parents, or what do you mean there?
So with heritability, unfortunately, it's like a concept that people tend to misunderstand all the time, but it's simply like, it's just like a statistical concept. It's just a number. It's the percentage of variability that you can explain in a given population at a given time in a certain trait. So for our study, we just put a number. 54% of the variability can be explained by genetic differences between people in the ability to perceive music.
How did you come up with that specific number, 54? What did you do in your study? How did you conduct it?
So the idea was to exploit the similarity between identical twins and non-identical twins. Identical twin shares all of their genes, while non-identical twin shares about half. And we simply ask people the way they experience music, and we observe that identical twins were much more similar than non-identical twins, more than double, actually. And we use a statistical model to recover that particular number.
I know this isn't the point of your study, but now I'm kind of surprised or interested in the fact that identical twins who have the same genetic information inside their bodies, that they would experience music differently. You must have seen that in the study then, that two people, two very, very, very similar people, then didn't react with as much pleasure to the same music?
Yeah, so it would be very interesting to look at the experience of identical twins to the same music. We just asked questions about how they, in general, interact with music. So questions, for example, whether they get chills from music sometimes, or even if they like to dance along with a beat, or things like that. And identical twins were much more similar in the way they were interacting with music, but non-identical. There were still like some uniqueness on average, even in identical twins. So there is some genetic influence on the trait, but there is also something that is unique to each of us.
And with regard to that unique to each of us, how exactly do or why do we feel pleasure when we listen to music? What happens inside our brain that makes us feel that feeling of pleasure when we hear music?
Yeah, this is the great question, right? The one that we would really like to answer. So some of our colleagues in the past described this condition. I don't know if you know about it. It's called musical anhedonia. So there are certain individuals that cannot experience pleasure from music, but they can experience pleasure virtually from everything else. And when they did neuroimaging studies, they found out that this individual had reduced connectivity between auditory cortices and reward-related regions in the brain. So the idea is that when we experience music, or when people cannot experience pleasure from music, there is a sort of disconnectivity between areas that make music a possible percept and areas that attribute value to that perception.
That connectivity that you were talking about, can it be changed? Or is there something that we can do to manipulate it or change it so that, I don't know, people who don't experience music pleasure from music as much as others could someday experience it that way?
This is a great question, one that I don't have an answer for. But since we're talking about this concept of genes, irritability, connectivity, changes, irritability doesn't mean immutable. Actually, something that is heritable can be still quite malleable. So the idea that our genetic effects do not imply that these things are fixed nor are wired. People developed in different environments and they have genetic predisposition, and this might interact with the environment they live in, and then this might influence the way these areas of the brain get connected through development. It's a lot of unanswered question, to be honest.
We've been talking at this point about musical anhedonia. Anhedonia being the inability to feel pleasure. Is there something, I'm just realizing this or thinking about it now, is there something or such thing as musical hyperhedonia? A person who, when music comes on, is overpowered by pleasure, almost pathologically, possibly? Like, does it go that far? Somebody who's wildly euphoric in a life-disrupting way because of music?
I would say definitely yes. So Oliver Sacks was talking about this in musicophilia, and Robert Zatorre and colleagues, I think, in some of their works, described hyperhedonia. So they divided groups in anhedonic, like normal hedonic, and sometimes hyperhedonic. And if I looked at my data, for example, we had this questionnaire and the maximum score was 100. And note that some of the items were reverse scored. So people would have need to answer one to get five, so it's not people that were just like ticking the boxes at the max. And certain people scored 100. So there were people that were definitely like on all aspects of music enjoyment, like very much enjoying music.
I'm imagining somebody, like they walk by a speaker box and it's playing the right kind of music and they almost melt, like they drop to the ground in pleasure. Does that kind of hyperhedonia exist?
I don't know. It would be in this modern world, it would be quite hard, I think, to leave and go around with a certain condition. But I mean, it's variability, right? And when you're talking about variability as a spectrum, you will have people at the end of both spectrums. So these people might exist.
And that was Jaco, or Giacomo Bignardi, speaking to us from Galatina, Italy. And you know how Italy is that boot, right? He is right now on the heel of that boot.
In the middle of the heel.
In the middle of the heel.
Yeah. And he said...
At his parents' place down there.
Yeah. That right now things are calm there, despite a lot of action in the rest of Italy, or in, at least in Rome. Calm and sunny.
Yeah.
The kind of temperatures that make us a little bit envious here in Bonn, Germany, at the moment, where the rain is pouring down. But that is neither here nor there. The reason I asked about hyperhedonia with connection to music, I was thinking of you, Gabe, because I think on the spectrum of hedonias, or the ability to feel pleasure for anything, but in this case music, you would be on the hyper side of things when it comes to music?
I'm not sure always. Like you described that situation of walking past a music box and just melting down. I don't have that. But at least once a day, I put my headphones on and play Bob Marley, some reggae music, and I take my Dalmatian dog up into the forest. We've got the forest is about 10 minutes away, and once I get underneath those towering beech trees with my dog running off the leash and Marley hits my ears, I start almost jumping, like galloping, looking up to these towering beech trees with my hands up in the air. I can feel the music, like light entering my body. And yeah, that is absolute pleasure. I am describing to you an absolutely pure source of pleasure for me. I genuinely wonder whether other people, if they see what's happening, whether they would find that abnormal, or whether other people, given the right set of circumstances and genes, whether that would be normal behavior.
I think
what's happening.
Germans would find your behavior highly inappropriate in the quietude of a German Wald or forest, and then this maniac jumping around with his noise-canceling headphones and singing Marley with a Dalmatian at his side. You're going to get the police called on you. Although maybe you can then tell the police, no, I have musical hyperhedonia as a result.
It's just the connectivity, the auditory connectivity inside my brain, Herr Offizier.
Anyway, how do you feel? How do you experience musical pleasure the way Gabe does, or is it more neutral for you, or are you one of the people who really doesn't? I mean, what's interesting is we were talking not about an inability to understand or care for music at all. It's just about feeling pleasure for it, so you can intellectually understand it and appreciate it. Mm. Do you feel pleasure when you hear it?
Or do you know any twins that feel different levels of pleasure? Can you weigh on that debate? Because I found that really fascinating.
Yeah.
Either way, let us know at su@dw.com. And thank you guys for listening.
DW. Made for minds.